1 Corinthians 1:10 through 1:13, the second in a series on 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on March 10, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to continue this morning with our look at 1 Corinthians. We just barely got started last week. Today we're going to launch into the body of the letter, starting in verse 10 of chapter 1. Let me just make a comment about what I'm going to do before I do it. Thank you. A lot of what I'm going to talk about today has to do with the background of the letter. How can we get some sort of perspective on what is happening, especially in these first chapters of the letter of 1 Corinthians? What is it that's going on in Corinth, and what is Paul talking about? I just wanted to say before I launch into that, I think that probably most of you are tracking with this, but I want to make sure that everybody understands how I'm looking at this. I don't want to give you the impression that I think that we're here for a history lesson or something. I mean, that we're here so that I can pontificate on various abstract historical pieces of information or something like that. I know, you know, that we are gathered together here because of what we believe. We're gathered together here because we face tough choices in life. What does it mean to trust God? Am I willing to trust God? Am I willing to know God? Am I willing to turn away from the attractive lies that I find in the culture around me? How am I going to respond to the challenges in my own life? And some of those challenges are pretty big. We all know that that's true. And the fact that most of what I have to say today is talking about people that were dead a long time ago and the city that has changed quite a bit since then. I mean, I know what it is we're here for, but I firmly believe that we can't understand what Paul is getting at in a letter like 1 Corinthians unless we understand what he's talking about. And we can't understand what he's talking about if we don't understand the situation into which he's writing. 1 Corinthians, the first several chapters of 1 Corinthians, has several popular passages in it, passages that get used to make various points. And my experience has been, as a Christian, that over the years I have heard those passages taught a lot of times, and most of the time I don't think they've been taught correctly. They haven't been saying what it is that Paul was saying. And one of the biggest mistakes that people make is that they don't pay attention to the coherent picture. They don't try to put together in the first chapters of 1 Corinthians, what is Paul talking about? What is the issue? What does he have on his mind? And so what happens is we grab a little chunk of verses over here, and we grab a little chunk of verses over here, and we end up missing the point. I mean, I haven't actually taught through 1 Corinthians in this group. I don't think I've ever done it. But 1 Corinthians is a book that we use a lot around the study center when we're introducing people to the challenge involved in interpreting the Bible, because it's one of those places where when you start to see the whole picture, when you start to recognize, oh, there's an issue that Paul has on his mind, the fog starts to lift and you can start to see something of what's going on. So this is a book that we end up talking about a lot, even though I don't know that we've ever really talked about it here. So today, a lot of what I have to say is about what's going on. What's the background? What's going on in Corinth? But it's not because I think that history is in and of itself the purpose for our gathering together. But the fact is that the history of the New Testament, the history of these people, is very relevant to us because it is what informs the revelation of God. Paul wrote to them saying, hey, you guys, it's like this. But the guys that he was talking to were particular guys who had particular problems, and we want to try to understand something of that so we can understand what is he trying to tell them. So that's my little warning that today a lot of the discussion is going to be about background, but it is firmly my intention to get to the point. Sooner or later, I am going to get to the point, so just hang on. Okay. So we start out, verse 10 launches into the first of the big issues that Paul addresses in 1 Corinthians. It may not be immediately apparent to you, but I would say that the first issue basically goes through the first four chapters of the book. Here is his opening salvo in the letter. Now I urge you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all agree, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be united in the same mind and in the same judgment. For I have been told about you, my brethren, by those of Chloe's household, that there are quarrels among you. Now I mean this, that each of you is saying, I am of Paul, and I of Apollos, and I of Cephas, and I of Christ. Has Christ been divided? Paul was not crucified for you, was he? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul? I give thanks to God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius, so that no one might say you were baptized in my name. Now, I also baptized the household of Stephanas. Beyond that, I do not know if I baptized anyone else. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not in wisdom of word, in order that the cross of Christ might not be nullified. Okay. If we were to only read this paragraph in 1 Corinthians, I think we might come away with a certain picture of what it is Paul is concerned about. It's the classic deal. You know, you have different teachers in a church, and some people like one teacher better, and some people like another teacher better. In this case, some like Apollos better, some prefer Peter, some like to listen to Paul. And there are these kind of cliques that are forming. You know, you notice when Paul shows up, there are some people that are there, and others people that kind of aren't around. And then if Peter ever shows up, comes around, then there's a lot of people that show up for him, but some of these folks don't come. And these groups are sort of disapproving of each other. You know, they think, well, no, our guy's best. We like him better. And it's gotten to the point where they're actually arguing with each other and not getting along. And in this picture, Paul is telling them, you need to stop bickering about which teacher you like the best, and instead you need to get along with each other. However, the point that I want to make this morning to really set up everything we're going to be saying for the next several weeks is that there are a number of strong clues in the Bible that suggest that Paul has something much bigger in mind than the scenario that I just described. The problem is a lot deeper than the picture that I just laid out. And that problem, we really do need to understand something of that problem in order to make any sense out of what he's doing in 1 Corinthians. So before we start talking about this first paragraph here, what it is he says, we really need to take a detour for a minute and look at the clues that we can find as to what is it that's going on. And I would say there are three kinds of clues that are going to be helpful to us in this situation. First of all, there are clues in the immediate context. And by the immediate context, I mean here the first four chapters of Corinthians. There are clues from other parts of the Bible. And there are some clues from our knowledge of history. So first of all, let me talk to you about the clues in the immediate context. Whatever the issue is in this section, this would be my first clue. We need to pay attention to the fact that really the first four chapters of Corinthians seem to be about this problem. He talks about the divisions at the beginning, and then it may seem that he abandons that discussion and he starts talking about wisdom and various things. But when we get to chapter 3, we find him once again referring to the problem of when one says, I am of Paul, and another, I am of Apollos. He hasn't really abandoned this topic. He has it on his mind. And even when we get to chapter 4, we find him saying, now these things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos for your sakes, saying that, talking about what he has been talking about earlier. He has this situation where people are lining up with Paul or Apollos or whoever. He has it in mind throughout these first several chapters. So it does suggest that that's going to be the theme that ties everything together in the chapters that we're about to look at. Second clue, I think, that is interesting is the strange turn that Paul takes at the end of this paragraph. Because he starts out talking about these divisions and about how he's glad that he didn't baptize anyone, very many people when he was there because of what that might contribute to the divisions that are going on. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then he says, out of the blue, sort of, he makes this comment that Christ did not send him to preach with wisdom of word, with wisdom of speech. Where did that come from? Why did he start talking about that? And it's not just an offhand comment, because in the next several chapters, the big theme that he's going to talk about is wisdom and speech. He's going to talk about the wisdom of the world and comparing the cross, the wisdom, the word of the cross is being compared to the wisdom of the world. He talks about how he spoke when he was among them, that he didn't use persuasive words of wisdom. He defends the idea that the gospel is really true wisdom from God. He says that when he was with them, he spoke to them not like spiritual people, but like almost like children. Again, the issue being, how did he speak when he was there? And he reminds them again that the wisdom of the world is foolishness. If we were to look at these first four chapters, which keep coming back to this question of the division between them, there is a lot more said in this section about wisdom and the wisdom of what Paul preaches versus the wisdom of the world than there is anything about divisions or getting along or anything like that. So that's a very interesting fact. In a section where he starts out to talk about the divisions among them, he spends most of his time talking about the way he speaks and the wisdom of the gospel. Okay, clue number 3. Although Paul starts out mentioning several groups, most of his discussion is about himself and Apollos. So he does mention, some might say, I am of Cephas, and that's Peter. Others might say, I am of Christ. But when we get into the discussion itself, the contrast that he keeps making is between those who would say they're with Paul and those who would say they're with Apollos. And Apollos is the name that keeps coming up. And that's an interesting clue, I think. And then finally, in this section, I think it's very interesting and very significant that much of what Paul says in these chapters is about himself. It's about how he speaks. It's about how they should think about him. Some of it really has the flavor that Paul is defending himself against a certain perspective in the church. And once you start to see that, you realize you can see more and more of it in what he does in these chapters. When he says Christ did not send him to preach in wisdom of word, there's a very strong possibility, if you stop to think about it, either that just came out of the blue, or else Paul is saying that Christ didn't send him to preach in wisdom of word because there are those who are saying that Paul should be preaching a certain way, that Paul should be using this wisdom that he's talking about. He tells them how he chose to speak when he was among them. I didn't speak with superiority of speech or wisdom. I chose to speak to you in a certain way, proclaiming Christ crucified. Again, he's defending how he chose to talk when he was among them. He defends the idea that what he does speak among the mature is wisdom. He tells them how they ought to think about Apollos and about him, about himself. He says that you should think of me as a steward of the mysteries of God. And then in a very significant statement in this section, he talks about how it is a very small thing to me that I should be examined by you. And he says to them, stop passing judgment before the time. That seems to indicate that it's not just a question of some people like to listen to Paul more than Apollos or vice versa. There's a very strong flavor here that there are those among the Corinthians who are passing judgment on Paul. They are examining him, finding him wanting in some way, and essentially dismissing him. He says, I said these things about Apollos and myself so that you might not be arrogant on behalf of one against the other. This is not just, oh, I like Paul a little better, I like Apollos a little better. This is actually, this group is, I am with him against him. So this is not just fashionable cliques. We're talking about serious, I like Apollos, I don't want to have anything to do with Paul. And he concludes this section with a sort of an ironic and sarcastic set of comments about how the apostles are weak, but the Corinthians are strong. And he ends these kind of ironic comments by saying, I don't say these things to shame you, but to admonish you. There seems to be some problem with the way some of the Corinthians are looking at Paul. There are strong hints that's going on in this section. Okay, so from the context, it seems to me, now I haven't gone into very much of an explanation of why I would say these things, but I'd like to suggest that there are strong hints that some Corinthians are comparing Paul unfavorably to Apollos, that the Corinthians, some of them, are charging Paul with being deficient in some way, and that the charge seems to have something to do with a lack of wisdom in the way Paul speaks, because Paul defends the way he speaks and dismisses the value of worldly wisdom. That, in fact, is what I think is going on in this section, but I'm just trying to point out to you that I think there are certain clues there that suggest something like that is going on. Okay. Now, a second set of clues I think that are going to be significant for us are clues that we can find from the rest of the Bible. And there are two places I would like to take us. I know for some of you this is old hat. Some of you have been down this road with us before, but I want to cover all the bases here. First of all, we want to go to the book of Acts, chapter 18. You don't have to turn there if you don't want to. What we find here is the story of Paul's first encounter with the Corinthians and the creation of the church in Corinth. Paul is on his second missionary journey. He goes to Corinth, I don't know, probably somewhere 50 to 52 AD. He meets Aquila and Priscilla, who are Jews, supports himself by working with them as tent makers, and on the weekends, on the Sabbath, he goes into the synagogues and is arguing with the Jews, trying to make a case that Jesus is the Messiah. The Jews, for the most part, don't listen to him. He basically says, all right, I'm done with you guys. He goes to the Gentiles, which starts by, he basically goes next door to the synagogue, to the house of Titius Justus, who is a Gentile God-fearer, probably a fairly well-to-do person who had a house that was big enough for people to meet in. Crispus, the Jewish ruler of the synagogue, also believed. We know that Paul stayed for a year and a half. He ends up being charged with something that doesn't hold up. After the hearing, the crowd beats up Sosthenes, who is probably the guy that Paul is dictating this letter to. And after this period of time, Paul leaves Corinth and he goes to Ephesus with Priscilla and Aquila. Now, we're going to refer to this several times as we go along through the book. You want a picture. We've got this sort of horseshoe of land. I'll be the Aegean Sea here, and we've got this horseshoe of land around. With over on the west, we have Greece, where Corinth is, and then around over here, on this side, we have Asia, and Ephesus is over here. So Paul goes across, leaves Corinth, goes over to Ephesus, and then leaves Priscilla and Aquila there. Okay, now the clue that I want to talk about here is the discussion that we see after this about Apollos. Here is where Apollos comes into the picture. In Ephesus, over here, Priscilla and Aquila, after Paul has left, meet this guy named Apollos. And let me read what it says. Now a certain Jew named Apollos, an Alexandrian by birth, an eloquent man, came to Ephesus, and he was mighty in the scriptures. This man had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit, he was speaking and teaching accurately the things concerning Jesus, being acquainted only with the baptism of John. And he began to speak out boldly in the synagogue. But when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. And when he wanted to go across to Achaia, the brethren encouraged him and wrote to the disciples to welcome him. And when he had arrived, he helped greatly those who had believed through grace. For he powerfully refuted the Jews in public, demonstrating by the scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. And it came about that while Apollos was at Corinth, Paul, having passed through the upper country, came to Ephesus. Okay, so what do we learn from this story? We learn that Apollos was a powerful debater because he knew the scriptures well. He publicly argued with the Jews and proved them wrong from the scriptures. He was the kind of guy who went boldly into public arenas, maybe in the synagogue, maybe in other places, and sort of challenged the Jews on the question of, is Jesus the Messiah? Yes. And he was taking them on and making a good case. It says that he was, New American Standard has eloquent. The word is logios. He was a logios man. And this word can lean, as Jack talked about with us before, this word can lean sort of either in the direction of eloquent or learned, educated. I think in this context, the distinction sort of becomes almost irrelevant. Clearly, the nature of his eloquence that we're talking about here is he knows the scriptures well, and he can speak powerfully, clearly, and to the point in arguing about the fact that Jesus is the Messiah. He was skilled at going out and talking to people about these ideas and defending these ideas. So clearly Apollos was an impressive man as a speaker in the sense of as he is talking to people and making the case for the gospel, people say, well, wow, this guy's good. At the same time, it's also interesting to note that Apollos, although he's very knowledgeable in the scriptures, is somewhat new to the things of the gospel. We can debate. Jack argued that Apollos may not have known specifically about Jesus at all yet. I think you could make a case that he would have known basically about Jesus, as much as he would have learned from John the Baptist, yet that, yeah, that's the guy. He's the Messiah. But I think what's clear is that he doesn't know the teaching of Jesus. It's John the Baptist who has influenced him. He's not really familiar with the apostles and the proclamation of what Jesus taught and what the church was doing. So he's an interesting mixture of maturity in his understanding of the scriptures and yet naivete too, as in that a lot of what Jesus taught would be new to him. Aquila and Priscilla take him aside and they straighten him out on some things. So, after that, Aquila and Priscilla tell him, you ought to go over to Corinth. They could use you over there, you know. We started a church over there, and these guys, you could really help them out. So Apollos goes over, and he does help them out. He's debating with the Jews about the Christ, and this is helpful to people. It helps them to become more convinced of the truth of what it is that they've believed. It is interesting to note that Paul spent a lot of time for a while arguing in the synagogues about Jesus, and he didn't seem to get very far. So we have the Corinthians here with the opportunity to compare Paul and the way he did it when he was there with Apollos and the way he does it when he shows up. And one last thing about Apollos, I will point out that at the end of the letter to the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians, Paul says that basically Apollos is with him. And he encourages Apollos. He said, I encouraged him to come to you, but he doesn't want to come right now. And I know it's hard. I don't want to read too much into it, but I think most people find it hard to resist the notion that Apollos doesn't want to go back right now because of the mess that he got involved with and that he would rather just stay away for right now. Okay. Clue number two comes from the second letter that Paul wrote to the Corinthians. Now, I shouldn't put it that way. It's actually not the second letter he wrote to them. It's probably at least the fourth letter he wrote to them. But we only have two of them. So the second of the letters that we have to Paul, from Paul to the Corinthians, at the end of that letter, this is the spot in Paul's relationship with the Corinthians where the gloves come off and he goes right at it. I mean, this is where the problem that is happening with some of the people in Corinth, not all of them, but there is a party of people in Corinth with which he's having problems. He takes it on directly in the last chapters of 2 Corinthians. And it has the most biting, incisive, sarcastic, powerful sort of exhortations that any letter in the New Testament has, as far as I'm concerned. It's chilling to read the last several chapters of 2 Corinthians. I would die. If Paul had ever written a letter like this to me, I would just curl up under a bed somewhere and not want to come out, because this is brutal. It really is. But there are a couple of things that he says there that are very instructive in picturing how it is that some of the people in Corinth think about Paul. In chapter 10, verse 9, he says, "For I do not wish to seem as if I would terrify you by my letters. For they say, his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive and his speech contemptible. Let such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters when absent, such persons we are also in deed when present." Okay, so here, there are those in Corinth that are saying Paul's personal presence is unimpressive and his speech is contemptible. In chapter 11, verse 5, he says, "For I consider myself not in the least inferior to the most eminent apostles. But even if I am unskilled in speech, yet I am not so in knowledge. In fact, in every way we have made this evident to you in all things." So here we have, I mean, clearly, there are people in Corinth who think of Paul as being inadequate as an apostle. And the grounds of their view of him being inadequate is that he is unskilled in speech. And finally, in verse 12, he says, "Actually, I should have been commended by you, for in no respect was I inferior to the most eminent apostles, even though I am a nobody. The signs of a true apostle were performed among you with all perseverance by signs and wonders and miracles." I mean, basically, Paul is just kind of pulling out the big guns and saying, "Excuse me, apostle, I am an apostle. Remember me? I was like doing the miracles and stuff. Can you guys do that? I can. You want to know why? Because God says that I'm an apostle and you're not. I mean, that's basically what it's coming down to here. I mean, he's saying, come on, you guys, what are you thinking? So, wow, I just poked myself really hard. That was brilliant. That's because I'm such a skilled speaker. Okay, so if we look at the picture that emerges as we look at Acts and we look at 2 Corinthians, we see a picture of Apollos, who is a man of words, a powerful debater, and he obviously made a big impression on the Corinthians when he arrived. On the other hand, many in Corinth look at Paul as being personally unimpressive, speaking without skill. His speech is contemptible, and they don't really accept him as an apostle at all. Okay, I think you can kind of see the drift of where I'm headed here, but there's one more bit of information I want to bring into the picture. This has to do with one clue that we can gather from our knowledge of history. I think this is significant. We want to be careful and not be simplistic about what would have been going on in Corinth. I'm sure the situation was quite complex. But it is interesting to note in Greek history that there is an interesting group that had a lot of influence over the years called the Sophists. The Sophists, the word Sophist comes from the Greek word Sophia, which means wisdom. And in fact, it's the word that Paul used there in the passage we read, where he says, Paul, Jesus didn't send me to preach the gospel with wisdom of word. He didn't send me to preach with Sophia. The Sophists had been around for a long time. They kind of went in and out of favor over the years. They were philosophers and teachers. They were particularly known for developing their skills in rhetoric and debate. They prided themselves on their ability to win arguments, and in fact, particularly to win arguments on either side. It's sort of, basically, if you think about sophists and think about the modern lawyer, they actually have a lot in common. I mean, and I mean that actually historically, they were in fact like lawyers in a lot of ways. They would be hired by people to make their case, to go before, if they were on trial or if they had some sort of hearing that was going on, the sophist would be the one who would get up and make the case for why a certain thing ought to happen. So they were debaters. They were good at getting in and clinching the deal, at coming in and saying, see, this is what's true. They boasted that they could make the worse appear to be better. And this is a famous issue in Greek philosophy. Part of the reason that Socrates was killed is that he was charged, in essence, with being a sophist, that he was one who went around making the worse appear better. And, of course, he denied the charge. But many people looked upon the sophists with contempt because of this sort of, you know, have mouth will travel sort of, you know, just whoever will pay me, I'll make the case. But there was also a growing renewal of appreciation of the sophists and their skill at speaking at this time. As I understand it, by the end of Paul's century, the sophists had really kind of come into a fair amount of favor again. Now, it's hard to know where things exactly would have been in Corinth. I don't know the answer to that question. But what's striking is that what people liked about the sophists was their ability to debate, to speak skillfully in order to persuade others to look at things a certain way. Okay, so what is it that we see when we put all of the clues together? Some in Corinth are unimpressed with Paul and find him to be unskilled and contemptible in speech. Apollos, who is a man of words and a powerful debater, comes to Corinth after Paul and impresses the people there, especially with his ability to debate the Jews and make the case that Jesus is the Christ. A split develops, with some seeing themselves as rejecting Paul because of his lack of skill and so on. They don't really take him seriously, and for them, Apollos is their guy. In response to this, Paul defends the way he speaks. He says he has no intention of using Sophia, wisdom, in the way that he does this, even though there seems to be some interest that he would do that. Says that the wisdom of the world is foolishness when compared with the gospel, and he tells them to stop judging him. So, Paul is not just writing to a situation where cliques have developed. He is writing to a situation where some of the people have rejected him as their teacher, and they think that Apollos is much more impressive. These divisions that they have are deep divisions. These are divisions that have to do with people saying, basically, I don't think Paul is worth listening to. Paul, the apostle to the Gentiles, is not worth listening to. Apollos has wisdom. Paul does not. So I would say that in the next four chapters, the theme is not so much, I wish you guys would get along, but rather it's more, my God, you incredible idiots, how can you think that the gospel is unimpressive? That's the kind of theme that we're going to be exploring as we go through these next chapters. That's what I see as at stake in what it is that we're about to look at. Okay? So, we have a few minutes left. Why don't I talk about 1 Corinthians? Verse 10. Paul starts out by referring to the splits that are growing among them, and he basically tells them to cut it out. Now I urge you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all agree and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be united in the same mind and in the same judgment. Okay. Now remember what I just said about the nature of the splits that we're talking about here. This passage is often used to urge Christians to be united. Don't let theological disagreements come between you. Paul just wants us all to get together. And so I don't know how many times that, I mean, it's almost a reflex among Christians. You get to this verse and we have to start lamenting the fact that we have so many denominations and stuff like that. You know, this is bad. We need to just all get together and just be united. Let's get together, for goodness sakes. That's what Paul is saying here. It's how people often say. But notice something very important. Paul is not saying, I urge you, brethren, that you get along. He is saying, I urge you to agree. He is saying, I urge you to be united in the same mind and in the same judgment, in the same perspective on things. You can just do a thought experiment. If the Corinthians were to write back to Paul and say, you know, we heard what you had to say about being united and everything, and we agree with you. We think that's right. So we've all decided that you're a schmuck and that we like Apollos. We're all together on this. We're 100%, you know, there is harmony. No quarrels going on here. How would Paul respond to that? Would he say, oh, great, I'm so glad you took my advice and you're being united? Of course not. When he says, I want you to agree and be united in the same mind and in the same judgment, he wants them to agree about what is true and what's important. The ones who have chosen Apollos over Paul, or Peter over Paul, or whatever, are not thinking right. They are fools, as he's going to make clear as he goes along in this. Their split is based on the wrong beliefs. It's based on the wrong values. Some of them actually believe that rhetoric is more important than content. What does it matter that Paul preaches the truth? He is an unimpressive speaker. This is the problem that Paul is facing here. In point of fact, they really can't be understanding the gospel that they say they believe if they can so easily dismiss Paul. how could I seriously see myself as a disciple of Christ and listen to the proclamation of the central truth of all reality, the truth that is going to save me from destruction, and say, yeah, but he's so boring. I mean, so what? So what if he's boring? I mean, this is getting personal, because us boring people would like people to stop thinking about those kinds of issues. The fact is, you know, the issue is, what are you talking about? Is what you're saying true or not? So, how is it that they're going to be united? They have to stop being fools and join together in valuing and believing the truth. That's the direction we're going to go in 1 Corinthians as we go along here. He is urging them to be united by a number of them need to stop thinking wrongly about things and start thinking rightly. They need to stop valuing worldly wisdom and start valuing the truth of the gospel for what it is. And when they do, they will be united in mind and in perspective, and they will agree. That's what he wants. The agreement he's looking for is not, oh, forget about those theological things and just get along with each other. He wants them to get their theology straight so they can agree with each other. So he goes on to tell them what he's heard about it. He says, "For I have been told about you, my brethren, by those of Chloe's household, that there are quarrels among you. Now I mean this, that each of you is saying, I am of Paul, and I of Apollos, and I of Cephas, and I of Christ." Chloe is probably a woman's name. We don't know anything about her. Perhaps she is a wealthy widow whose servants travel back and forth between Ephesus and Corinth. How is it that Paul's hearing about what's happening in Corinth? Maybe Chloe lives in Corinth and some from her household have come over to Ephesus. Maybe Chloe lives in Ephesus and some of her servants have gone over to Corinth and then come back and told Paul. We don't know. But he's getting this report from them that these quarrels are going on. Paul mentions four groups here. But as I mentioned before, as the discussion goes on, we really abandoned the issue of people aligning themselves with Cephas, and it really boils down to Paul and Apollos. That seems to be the big deal. I would see the situation as something like this. There are, as we know, many in Corinth who are dissatisfied with Paul. The main group of them find Apollos to be much more impressive. There may be others, a smaller group, who have decided, well, okay, yeah, Paul is not so hot, so let's get back to the real apostle. That would be Peter. We all know that he's an apostle. I mean, Jesus basically put his hand on him and said, you're my guy. So how more authentic an apostle can you get than Peter? There are, in response to this, some who have declared their loyalty to Paul. But as we're going to see, Paul's not particularly happy with this either. They seem to have done it in such a way that they are sort of pitting him against Apollos and everyone else. And he's not happy with that either. And then finally, there are some who merely align themselves with Christ. Maybe they rightly recognize that this divisiveness is foolishness. Maybe they just say, well, no, you guys, we're just all followers of Christ. That would be the positive way to look at that group. Or maybe they have cut themselves off from Paul and Peter and Apollos and everyone and say, we don't listen to anybody but Jesus. We just follow Christ. Forget Paul, forget Peter. We're just followers of Christ. We don't know. This is the only reference to this that we have in the letter. We don't know anything about what that would be. But it doesn't seem to be a huge deal. The huge deal, as I've said, is this Apollos and Paul thing. Apollos seems to be the focus of a problem that's happening here. And I might as well say now, just not to keep you in suspense, that I don't think it's really Apollos. Paul is not against Apollos. We know that Apollos is with him and he's urging him to go back. So Apollos and Paul are fine. I don't think he sees Apollos as being the instigator of this problem. He may have contributed to it in the way he handled things when he was there, but he did not try to cause this split. So I don't think Apollos is the guy who caused the problem, but he is the focus of the problem. So Paul cuts to the heart of the issue then. Has misled some people when they start into 1 Corinthians, because here clearly Paul is saying, no, I don't want you guys, you know, picturing yourselves as my disciples. That's not the way I want it. And so people have gotten the idea that the major problem that Paul is addressing is people making too much of him. Well, as you read along in the 2 Corinthian letters, it's clear Paul's problem in Corinth is not that he has too many people making too much of him. His problem is that he has too many people making too little of him and basically dismissing him. So he is concerned here. He does not like the cliques that have formed, and he doesn't want people saying, "I follow Paul." He, as he's making clear here, he wants them to say, "I follow Christ." But most of the four chapters coming up are going to be Paul's defense of himself against people who reject him. But here, he is starting out with this correction to the other side. Don't turn me into your guru here. That's not how this works. What is the bond that unites us, he's saying? We are those who have been saved from sin and destruction by the crucifixion of Christ, by the death and resurrection of Christ. Does Paul think that people should listen to him? Yeah, they should. But why should they listen to him? Because he is an apostle of Christ. Christ sent him to proclaim his message. Should we listen to Peter as well, to Cephas? Yes, we should. We should listen to Peter because he is an apostle of Christ with Christ's message. Should they listen to Apollos? Yes, they should listen to Apollos. Why? Because he understands the scriptures and he's defending the idea that Jesus is the Christ. You should be listening to Paul and Apollos and Peter and anyone who proclaims the truth of the gospel. Why? Because the central truth of all reality has to do with Jesus the Messiah, whom we follow. That's why. The problem is that the Corinthians have gotten into this set of divisions. The rejection of Paul by some has created a response by others where they say, no, you know, Paul's our guy. To defend Paul as a true apostle would be a good response by the Corinthians. But to say, Paul is my teacher, not Apollos, is to turn Paul into something that he doesn't want to be. Okay. Let me stop at that. It's always hard. I'll stop there. We'll go on to the baptism part next time. Okay, so what have we got here? Let me just wrap it up and then I'll give you a minute to say what you'd like to say. It seems to me very important what we see developing in this section as to what Paul is starting to say about the issue of divisions and unity. As I said before, we tend to emphasize the strategy of let us overlook disagreements. That's what being united is all about. And that is partly true. There are disagreements about things among Christians that we ought to overlook and work towards accepting each other and seeing each other as being united together in spite of those differences. And the Bible has some things to say about that sort of thing. Paul himself is going to give that kind of advice later on in 1 Corinthians. But it is equally important, and maybe even more important ultimately, for our unity to be based on a unity around the right thing. We are united because we have embraced the gospel as true and significant and important. We have invested our lives in the truth of it. That's what unites us. And if we're united by anything else, we're united by the wrong thing, or at least by an irrelevant thing. Any other kind of unity that you can arrive at, it may be nice to be getting along with everyone, but it's not the kind of unity that we're striving for. So believing the truth is the road to true Christian unity. That's the picture that Paul has. I think, secondly, we're going to have a lot to say about this as we go along, so I won't say much about it this morning because this theme is going to keep coming up. But the issue of style over substance is an issue that Paul is addressing in these sections. In the end, what is it that is more important to you? And that's something, especially in a culture like ours, which is so influenced by this picture that we get in the media of what the successful person looks like and the person worth following and being interested in looks like, that we really ought to pay attention to the fact that evidently the man who had more to say to us about what Jesus Christ was all about than any other person seems to have been a fairly personally unimpressive person. That gives us a lot to think about, and we'll explore that more as we go along. Okay, so I've given us 5 minutes. If you have any questions or comments or anything you'd like to go into, and then as you can see, next time we're ready to go. We're gonna be mowing through those verses. You watch. Hey, we got through a couple of them today. What do you want? Any questions? You don't have to. Over here.
It seems like Corinth is sort of a high-speed cosmopolitan place. If they had had cable TV, or if they had had, you know, some mass communications thing, sophistry would have been one of their big deals.
Yeah.
Like the Olympics was a big deal for
right.
them, and all
right.
kinds of other things.
Right.
And so they were promoters of, you know, urban culture and all the stuff, you know. So I can just imagine the unimpressive side of the gospel not fitting.
Yes.
Much like it doesn't fit in our world.
You know? Right.
And so somebody that blows into town like Apollos, who has that shine, you know, and can really whistle the right tune, you know, he becomes a spokesperson right away.
Right. Yeah, I can see that very easily as well. And there's another part that's hard to dial in. As we're going to see as you go through the book, there seems to be a split in the church as well along socioeconomic lines. We see the problem with the Lord's Supper this a number of chapters later on, where the haves are ignoring the have-nots and that sort of thing. It's hard to know how it all fits together, but it's entirely possible that even in kind of social terms, Apollos may have been the sort of person that was more impressive than Paul. After all, Paul is a tent maker. I mean, you know, and we see in the letter that there are people who object to Paul because he does not accept their patronage, basically. He doesn't take money from them. He's making tents. There's something dubious about him in those terms as well, as far as they're concerned. So, yeah, I think there may be any number of factors that come together to make this dazzling, powerful debater like Apollos. He fits. He's the kind of guy that we like. And Paul, I know we started the church and everything, but, oh, man, I mean, he's so embarrassing. So, yeah.
You may have brought this out, but I'm wondering if in the Corinthian church, something that I've noticed, like I taught high school in a small town, and being the band director there, I was considered some of the intellectual elite. And I'm wondering if there's some of this type of division also in Corinth, like we're educated, sophisticated, we're international, and so on. And some of the other ones may have had, quote, blue-collar jobs at that time. Because I've been in situations where a church was, you know, I was really the only one who was really well-educated.
Yeah.
And I really didn't like the way people looked up to me, because it kind of made me feel uncomfortable. It's like, I'm not really that sophisticated. I mean, I put my shoes and pants on just like you. And there's talents that I have that you don't. In fact, when they were renovating the church, I mean, I can't put up sheet wall. I don't know anything about plumbing and so on. And I'm just wondering if you think this is something that was...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's hard to get definitive about exactly what the problem was, but the whole concept of wisdom is at stake in this section, as we're going to see. And it has to do with that ability to speak persuasively, but it's not just empty rhetoric either. I mean, when I said style over substance earlier, I want to be careful. It's not just empty, flowery speech. What they would be interested in is people who had the kind of knowledge that they could use persuasively in arguments to win and to make their way and to win people to their side and that sort of thing. So it does have to do with a certain perspective of there is a wisdom that is worth having. It's the wisdom that gets you someplace in this world. And if we want to talk about it as an intellectual elite, then I think there could be some of that involved. Culturally, it may look a little different for them than it would in our situation, but I think in general it's something like that. Okay, well, like I say, next time we will try to stay in the text as much as possible.